Nebraska. Justice Miller Lerman is recused in this matter. Mr. Welch, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Police Court, Counsel. My name is Dave Welch. I represent the appellant and the plaintiff, Hancock State. This has to do with a commercial lease, a piece of property on 170th and West Dodge that had a Lone Star restaurant. My client entered into a contract lease with Lone Star from 2010 to 2006, 16 to lease this property. The inducement into entering into this lease was a guarantee that was identified within the lease that clearly states that they expressly entered into this lease pursuant to the guarantee given by the guarantor, Cactus. Then there's a guarantee that's signed off by Cactus in this case. Cactus is a Delaware corporation. The office is in Texas. Lone Star is a Nebraska corporation. I want to talk about personal jurisdiction. That's the bedrock of this case, as far as I see it at this point in time. The guarantee was entered into, as I indicated, the guarantor is the parent corporation of the lessee in this case. That it was expressly put into the lease. We're induced into entering into this lease because of the guarantee from Cactus. At that point in time. It also, the guarantee indicates that the terms of the lease apply, and the terms of the lease indicate Nebraska law, the controlling law in this case. All right, so we have a situation where they breached the lease. They pull out, as the judge determined, it was effective the end of February 2013. So halfway through the lease, they pull out. Well, in this particular case, Judge Rettelsdorf had determined that personal jurisdiction is not satisfied, that the court didn't have jurisdiction over Cactus in this case. And the argument that I have in that respect is that this takes me back to my first year in law school. Burger King came out in 1985 when I was my first year in law school. And I remember Professor Kurtz walking in with, this has just come off, and here's this new case on personal jurisdiction, and we addressed it at that time. And it gets into notions of fair play. It gets into what's substantial justice. It gets into should you anticipate getting hailed into a court, a tribunal in Nebraska. And we have a situation here where the guarantor has one of his subsidiaries up in Nebraska, and we say, hey, if you want us to enter into this lease, we want you to guarantee it. They say, yes, we will guarantee that up in Nebraska. And in that respect, we put it in the lease. The law of Nebraska applies. I believe that the notions of fair play clearly are satisfied, that substantial justice requires that they be able to be sued here in Nebraska.
So that's enough of a minimal contact?
Yeah, let me tell you, I think it is, yes. Because, first off, the long-arm statute is satisfied, I believe, under 25.536, Part 2. All right? That they should know that the Constitution of the United States would be satisfied by their entering into that guarantee.
Yes. Counsel, in your brief, I think you argued that 25.536 sub 1 had some application as to the subpart about insuring. But
that's a leap.
Okay.
I really think it's Part 2. I mean, I'm hanging my hat on Part 2. That's the satisfying part of this. And then to get to the minimum context, yes, I believe when you're trying to analyze notions of fair play, when you're talking about substantial justice, how could they not anticipate being sued in Nebraska when they enter into a guarantee for a business in Nebraska, a lease in Nebraska, that where the lease is incorporated by the guarantee?
How much significance do you place on the fact that this was a subsidiary whose obligation they were guaranteeing?
I think probably the less of all 4 points.
And how much emphasis do you place on this being Nebraska real estate that's being leased?
Most of my emphasis is being placed on a Nebraska lease, a Nebraska property, that they're guaranteeing the lease for the Nebraska property.
In the guarantee, does it anywhere say, describe the property as being in the state of Nebraska?
To be honest with you, I'd have to go back and read the lease. I'm sure, obviously, the address and everything else is identified as the state of Nebraska.
Well, let's assume that neither the address nor the legal description of the property appears in the guarantee document.
Okay.
Take that as a given.
All right.
Which I'll tell you it doesn't.
All right.
What difference does that make?
I think none, because the guarantee clearly indicates that the terms of the lease are incorporated into the guarantee. And the guarantee, by incorporating the lease...
Does it use the word incorporation?
Doesn't use the word corporation, that they, the terms of the lease are controlling. It is the language that I remember in this particular situation.
Thank you.
And in that respect, I believe that the notions of fair play are met. Think about this. If we're not allowed to bring them into Nebraska on this, we have to sue on the breach of the lease in Nebraska, get a judgment there, and go to Delaware and sue the guarantor in Delaware.
Delaware or Texas?
I think it's a Delaware corporation. That's where I would end up filing the lawsuit in this particular case. They have offices in Texas, but Delaware, I believe, is where the lawsuit would have to be brought. And so if when you look at the four parts in regards to the quality court case talks about, you know, as far as the convenience of getting a judgment and being able to... The convenience of that in regards to what burden does it put upon the defendant in a particular case, and what does this court, what does this jurisdiction, Nebraska, have in far as being whether we want to control this or not, and I would certainly think that would be the case. Why would you have a guarantee and have to go somewhere else to file suit on that when you've got a situation where the tenant doesn't have any money to pay, and that's why the only reason why you entered into the guarantee?
But assume we throw in with you on this issue,
okay,
but we don't on any of the other issues. So what do we do then? What's the relief look like?
The relief is that you remand the case back to the district court, all right, and she finds personal jurisdiction, and then I can have a judgment against Cactus and try to enforce that judgment.
So how do you get the judgment against Cactus at that point?
In the district court.
You have to retry the case?
No, I don't believe so. It was tried on stipulated facts. And all that she has to do, there's no indication that the guarantee isn't valid, but that's the only thing she would have to address is the guarantee. None of the facts in regards to the damages or anything else is going to change.
Okay, that's another thing I want to ask you about. In your brief, in your assignment of error, and I'm just picking out the one about damages for the moment.
All right.
You talk about, you say, that a court erred by overruling the motion for new trial and awarding an insufficient amount of damages. That's sort of two concepts lumped into a single assignment of error. In your standard of review section, you recite the standard for a motion for new trial, abuse of discretion. I don't quarrel with that. But does that abuse of discretion also apply to the second part of that assignment of error, or is it something else?
When you talk about the damages,
yes,
being the second part, I think when you file a motion for new trial and you set forth abuse of discretion in the elements, I guess, for a new trial, it incorporates elements from the trial itself. My position on the damages is it's a question of law that the judge determined that date of June 13, 2013 would be the cutoff because of the letter of intent to sell. And that, she said, anything more than that would be a punishment of the tenant on the breach of the lease. And I believe...
Is that an application of strictly of a rule of law, or is it the facts coloring what points you pick?
I don't think it's the facts at that point, because she's already determined that the lease, as far as the breach goes, was not terminated. We did not assume their breach, and that in that respect, we were trying to mitigate our damages. But when she thinks you can't sell the property, she makes the determination. But anything more than June 13th would be a punishment. This court has to look at it as a question of law, I believe. Is it a punishment to not allow us to do our due diligence in selling our property? Obviously, the purchase agreement wasn't entered into until September 2013, and then the closing on the property wasn't until April of 2014.
How does the fact that this was a stipulated trial impact the standard of review on the issue of damages?
On the issue of damages, I think it gets into whether her determining it was a punishment is a question of law, is how I'm looking at it. And it's not a punishment.
Assume that it's at least in part a question of fact.
Okay.
How does the fact that we have no live witnesses, we have entirely stipulated evidence,
sure,
how does that affect our standard of
you don't reweigh the evidence, obviously, and you have to determine that, just like a jury verdict, and it has to be clearly erroneous in this particular case, and you would have to determine that the determination, the factual determination of a punishment was clearly erroneous.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Deegan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, Mike Deegan on behalf of the appellees and cross-appellant. Let me begin by first addressing the personal jurisdiction issue that was addressed by counsel. I think the fundamental disagreement here is we have two separate undertakings. We have a lease that has all the Nebraska-specific obligations within that document. And then we have a separate guarantee, which is strictly a financial arrangement between Hancut, which is a company based in Arkansas, and the parent company, which is based in Texas.
Doesn't the guarantee undertake to guarantee performance of all of the terms of the lease?
It's the primary responsibility of a tenant is the payment of rent. So it is a guarantee that if the tenant fails in that primary obligation, that there will be a financial obligation.
Well, aren't there lots of other obligations placed on the tenant in the lease?
Which would need to be reduced to a judgment for damages and then enforced as a financial obligation of the guarantee, but yes.
So, I mean, it's not a guarantee of a sum certain, it's guarantee of performance. And you're saying that makes no difference. Is that essentially what I'm...
No, what I'm saying is that the obligations of the financial guarantor are simply whether they have an obligation to remunerate the landlord for the failure of the tenant to perform. So, stated another way, whether or not there's a breach of the underlying lease is a Nebraska-specific determination that would require Nebraska witnesses and the evidence necessary to prove whether or not there was a breach. The secondary question as to whether or not the guarantor is obligated to pay some portion of that judgment has nothing to do with the state of Nebraska. It has simply, if there is a judgment that has been rendered, there is an obligation that they have to pay that judgment if, in fact, the judgment has not been paid.
Suppose we disagree with that argument and the fact that it's a performance obligation as opposed to merely a payment obligation seems to us to be significant. What impact does that have on your argument? What's your fallback argument, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, my fallback argument, Your Honor, would be that this was a separate undertaking. They were not a party to the lease, and there has been no factual showing that there are any other contacts between the separate entity, which is Cactus, and the state of Nebraska. And, in fact, the guarantee was negotiated purely between parties in Texas and parties in Arkansas. The only connection to Nebraska is it guarantees performance of a lease that deals with property in the state of Nebraska.
Is the lease agreement incorporated into the guarantee agreement?
Your Honor, I'll have to confess I don't have a copy of the lease with me. I don't believe that the specific language incorporating is in the guarantee, but the guarantee does guarantee the performance of all the obligations of the lease. But for example, if this were not specifically a guarantee of one Nebraska restaurant, and let's assume that this is a guarantee that's backing up Lone Star for operations in four or five different states, has the guarantor by the act of guaranteeing those leases, subjected itself to jurisdiction in any of those states in which Lone Star operates. And my argument would be that, no, they have not. They've obligated themselves to litigate, either in Texas or in Arkansas, but the mere fortuitous circumstance of where these underlying properties or leases may exist does not subject them to being hailed into those jurisdictions to have to litigate those issues. So that would be my fallback argument, Your Honor. But if I may set that aside and reach what we believe to be the key issue here, which is the position we've raised on our cross-appeal, which is that the evidence that was before the court established an abandonment. And I think that's clearly the threshold issue that needs to be reached, because before you get to mitigation, which is an obligation for enforcement of lease terms, the first question is whether or not there's been an abandonment. Because when a tenant fails to meet their obligations and has materially breached the lease, the landlord has a choice to make. They can either hold the tenant to the obligations of the lease and enforce it through the terms with an obligation to mitigate, or the landlord may choose to retake the premises, to sell it, raise it, re-let it on different terms, or do whatever else the landlord wants to do at that
point. Can't they mitigate by selling?
Yes, Your Honor, I think they can. And I think the key case on mitigation by selling would be the Properties Investment Corp. Versus JBA case. But, Your Honor, that is a completely different set of circumstances. In that case, upon the breach of the lease, the landlord immediately took steps which were all consistent and indicative of their intention to enforce the lease. They hired a broker. They listed the property. They attempted to re-let the property. That was their goal, and all of the facts in that case demonstrated that that's how they proceeded for an entire year after the landlord had ceased payment of rent. It was only after it became clear that there was not a viable market to re-let the premises that the landlord then sold the property. And under those facts, I think there is a demonstration that the landlord intended to enforce the lease, and when they were unable, by reasonable means, to re-let the premises, they sold it. And so I don't think that's inconsistent with our position here.
Isn't the question of whether mitigation was reasonable a question of fact?
I think it is a question of fact.
And there it takes us to the standard of review. And what do you think is the correct standard of review, given that this is a law action, but also given that there were no live witnesses, it was purely upon stipulated evidence?
I think on the issue of mitigation, this court has to give significant deference to the trier of fact. But, Your Honor, I think it's a question of law as to whether or not the court should have first determined whether or not there was an abandonment. And I believe on the record before this court, the evidence, I would respectfully suggest, establishes that there was an abandonment. And that is a function of intent. And in the Wake Lumber case, the court very clearly stated that the question of intent can be inferred by the conduct of the landlord. And here, all of the conduct of the landlord immediately following the notification from the tenant that they intended to go dark, to stop operations, is wholly inconsistent with enforcing the lease. They immediately began negotiations to sell the property. This is before any broker had been hired or any effort whatsoever had been taken to relet the premises. They gave lip service to two prospective tenants that were brought to the landlord by my client, by the tenant. But those negotiations weren't for purposes of having them fill out and enforce the remaining terms of the original lease. The landlord in those instances was negotiating an entirely new lease. Again, completely inconsistent with enforcing an existing lease obligation that is consistent with a landlord that's decided to take back the premises and negotiate better terms. They never hired a broker, unlike the last time that they had a vacancy at that location. They refused to accept tenders that were presented to them by bona fide tenants. And ultimately, they did sell the property. They sold the property. The property was torn down and reoccupied by a new owner. So, Your Honor, our argument would be, as a matter of law, before you reach the issue of mitigation, would be whether the court was correct in determining that the evidence was not sufficient to demonstrate abandonment. If the property was abandoned, then we don't get to the second question, which is mitigation, which is an obligation for a landlord who is actually performing and holding the tenant to the lease. And if there are further questions, no further argument.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for this morning. The court is adjourned and you are excused.